The Book Corners and OpenStreetMap story, 111 points, 66 comments, is a case study in the economics and ethics of open source contributions. Book Corners is an app for locating public book exchanges, those little free library boxes you see in front of houses. The app collects user contributions. The question Andrea Grandi is addressing is, why doesn't Book Corners sync those contributions back to OpenStreetMap, the open database of geographic data where many of those locations may have originally come from?
The answer is legally and technically complicated, and it's a genuinely instructive situation. Contributing to OpenStreetMap requires agreeing to the ODBL, the Open Database License. When users contribute to Book Corners, they're agreeing to Book Corners' terms, not OpenStreetMap's. You can't retroactively impose the ODBL on data that was contributed under different terms without going back to every individual contributor and getting explicit reconsent. That's not a bureaucratic technicality. It's the legal architecture that protects open databases from having incompatible data mixed in.
From a business and policy perspective, this situation recurs constantly with location data, and it illustrates something important about how open data ecosystems work in practice. The value of OpenStreetMap comes from the clarity of its data provenance. If you could mix in data of unclear license compatibility, you'd undermine the legal certainty that makes OpenStreetMap usable for commercial applications. The license strictness is a feature, not a bug, even when it creates friction like this.
There's also a curriculum moment embedded in this story that's worth unpacking, because it touches on something analogous to antitrust law, specifically how legal categories that sound simple turn out to be technically precise in ways that matter enormously. Speaking of which, Marcus, I know you've been wanting to walk through the antitrust basics for a while, and the Fujitsu story that's also on the front page today actually provides a perfect hook for it.
It does. The Fujitsu story, 25 points, 9 comments, but with significant political weight, involves UK members of parliament demanding answers about why Fujitsu continues to be included in lucrative government IT procurement frameworks, despite the Post Office Horizon scandal, which revealed that faulty Fujitsu software led to the wrongful prosecution of hundreds of sub-postmasters over more than a decade. The scandal is one of the worst miscarriages of justice in modern British legal history. Parliament is asking, why is a company at the center of that still winning government contracts?
And here's where the antitrust and competition law context becomes relevant. When people hear antitrust, they often think it means the government breaks up big companies that have too much market share. But the legal reality is much more precise. The Sherman Antitrust Act in the US and its equivalents in the UK and EU isn't triggered by size alone. Having 90% market share doesn't by itself violate antitrust law. What matters is whether that market position was obtained or maintained through anti-competitive conduct, predatory pricing designed to eliminate competitors, exclusive dealing arrangements that foreclose rivals from the market, or acquiring companies specifically to kill their products.
A useful analogy. Imagine a restaurant that becomes the best in town through genuinely superior food. They have 70% of local dining revenue. That's not an antitrust problem. Now imagine they secretly pay the landlords on Main Street not to lease space to competing restaurants. That is an antitrust problem, not because of the market share, but because of the exclusionary conduct. Monopoly power, legally defined, means the ability to control prices or exclude competition. Market share is evidence of monopoly power, but it's not sufficient on its own.
In the Fujitsu case, the MPs aren't making an antitrust argument. They're making a procurement, integrity, and accountability argument. But the underlying mechanism is similar. What legal and regulatory constraints exist on how a government chooses its contractors, and what remedies are available when the process appears to have failed. The Post Office scandal created political liability that the procurement system hasn't resolved, and Parliament is now forcing that accountability question.
The note-taking and personal knowledge management piece, 209 points, 70 comments, is one of those perennial HN topics that consistently generates massive engagement. The specific essay today is a skeptical take on the elaborate systems that productivity communities build for organizing knowledge. Zettelkastens, linked databases, evergreen notes, progressive summarization. The author's argument, from what the thread indicates, is that the act of building the system often substitutes for the act of actually thinking and producing work. The system becomes the end rather than the means.
This connects to the ink and switch piece on convergence. Convergence is not enough, which scored 37 points with 7 comments and is a more technical take on collaborative data systems. The Ink and Switch Lab builds research tools for thought and collaboration, and their argument is that getting multiple users' edits to eventually reach the same state, convergence in the CRDT sense, is necessary but not sufficient for genuinely collaborative tools. What you also need is the tools to help users understand what changed and why, to make the merge history meaningful rather than just correct.
The Isopolis SF map, 238 points, 52 comments, is the most purely delightful thing on the front page today. It's an isometric pixel art rendering of San Francisco as an interactive map with extraordinary detail. The HN thread is full of people recognizing their neighborhoods, spotting specific buildings, debating the accuracy of particular blocks. It's a creative project with technical depth. Building that kind of map requires solving real problems in coordinate transformation, tile rendering, and data sourcing. But it's also just a beautiful thing that made a lot of people happy on a Monday morning.
And the Train Simulator Controller Project, a custom physical controller built for train simulation games, is exactly the kind of personal project that HN celebrates, because it demonstrates serious hardware engineering skill in service of pure enthusiasm. Building a physical controller that accurately replicates locomotive controls is a multi-domain engineering challenge involving electronics, firmware, mechanical design, and simulation protocol integration.
The Snow Leopard Myth essay, 106 points, 85 comments, argues against the nostalgic narrative that Mac OS X Snow Leopard was a uniquely clean, polish, and performance release unspoiled by new features. The author's contention, apparently, is that Snow Leopard did introduce substantial new capabilities, and the memory of it as purely a refinement release reflects a cognitive bias towards seeing the past as simpler than it was. It's a fairly niche historical argument, but it clearly touched a nerve. 85 comments for a piece about a 2009 operating system says something about how powerful platform nostalgia is.
The Read the Novels essay, 107 points, 92 comments, is arguing for something that feels almost radical in a tech context. That literary fiction is a form of knowledge and understanding that technical nonfiction, essays, and even excellent journalism can't replicate. The HN community engaging seriously with this argument is itself interesting. The comment ratio is high, which means people have opinions about it, and not just dismissive opinions.
Now, and this is where I want to push back on what might be the most confident technical claim that's emerged across today's stories, because I think it deserves some scrutiny.
The what if we're wrong question.
Exactly. The consensus forming across the Quen 3-8 Max discussion, the AI productivity gap piece, and the meat proxy debate is essentially this. Experienced developers benefit from AI coding assistance. Junior developers don't benefit as much, or may even be harmed. And therefore, the path forward is to ensure that developers build deep expertise before leaning heavily on AI tools. That's a coherent and appealing argument. I've made versions of it myself in this episode. But what if it's wrong in a specific and important way?
Walk me through the counterargument.
The counterargument goes like this. The claim that junior developers need to learn fundamentals before using AI assistance assumes that the fundamentals remain the same. But if AI tools become sufficiently reliable and their outputs become sufficiently verifiable through automated testing and formal verification, the relevant skill set for a software developer might genuinely shift. Not vanish, but shift. Just as the invention of high-level programming languages didn't eliminate all programming skill, but did change which skills mattered, AI code generation might change which fundamentals are load-bearing.
That's a real challenge to the consensus. The assumption embedded in build expertise before using AI is that expertise means what it meant in 2015. Deep understanding of implementation details, data structures, algorithm complexity. But if AI handles those layers reliably and the human's role becomes specifying intent, decomposing problems and evaluating outputs at a higher level of abstraction, then developing those older skills might be less important than developing new ones. Prompt engineering, system design at a conceptual level, interpreting test results.
And the strongest version of the counterargument, the one I find genuinely uncomfortable, is that insisting junior developers build expertise the old way before using Inkstend. iAssistants might create a cohort that's very skilled at things that are becoming less economically relevant, while the people who lean into AI tools early develop the intuitions that actually matter in the world those tools are creating.
So what would we watch for to know if we're wrong? I'd say, watch whether the quality differential between AI-assisted junior developers and non-AI-assisted junior developers closes over time as better evaluation tooling emerges. If you can build robust automated test suites, formal verification pipelines, and better static analysis that reliably catches the subtle errors that junior developers miss when accepting AI code, then the "you need to understand the code you ship" argument weakens substantially. The understanding moves from the developer's head into the tooling.
And conversely, if we see a pattern of production failures attributable to AI-generated code that wasn't understood by the developer who shipped it, and those failures are in categories that wouldn't have been caught by tests, that's strong evidence that the cognitive debt argument is correct and the expertise-first consensus holds.
The signal to watch is the postmortem literature. If incident reports over the next 2 years start attributing failures specifically to code was AI generated and misunderstood, that's the confirmation. If they don't, the consensus may need updating.